I'm going to finish up my observational pep talk, and then we'll start covering for the next probably day and a half, a classic paper by Maldacena on single field sorrel inflation. Okay, so EBD composition. So covariantly, linear polarization is a symmetric traceless two tensor on the sphere. It's easiest to understand the EBD composition in the flat sky limit, where this is just a traceless symmetric tensor on the Euclidean plane. In which case you can decompose it into its Stokes parameters q and u, the same way that you just, for a vector field, you would just decompose it into its xy components. And then last time we argued that the most interesting way of dividing this object with 2 degrees of freedom into two objects with 1 degree of freedom, with 1 degree of freedom each, was the EBD composition, which in Fourier space looks like this. By the way, every cosmologist is hardwired to denote wave numbers by L if they're in 2D or K if they're in 3D. Okay. So for each L, you apply this rotation that defines two numbers, E and B at L. And what's interesting about this decomposition is that it's rotation invariant, and a rotated observer sees the same EBD composition, even though they would disagree over whether the field is Q or U. There's also a parity difference. B, if you flip the coordinate system, B gets an extra minus sign compared to what a scalar field would get. Okay, now... To understand how this generalizes in this form, it's not totally obvious how this is going to generalize to the curved sky. But if I write the matrix a little differently, let's write cosine of 2 phi L as Lx squared minus Ly squared over L squared, which I'll absorb into this vector. So I can write this as 2x ly. In this step, I've just used some trig identities. Then you can see that a mode is an E-mode. A mode is an E-mode. If it's obtained by, let's see, I suppose I should have, this would be most transparent if I inverted the matrix. So let me just, sorry to force you to correct your notes, but let me just put Q on this side, U on this side, invert the rotation matrix by switching the sign, and put E and B on this side. Okay. Sorry about that, I should have written it the other way. Okay. So a mode is an E mode, the B here is zero, if and only if Q of L is, so if I were to set B to zero, then this equation would read Q sub L is Lx squared minus Ly squared EL over L squared, and U sub L is 2 Lx Ly times E sub L over L squared. And I can write these equations in real space. You'll see where this is going in a sec. Like this. Times some function f, the Fourier transform of EL over L squared. Okay, and UL, I could write this in real space as 2 del x del y f of x. Okay, so an equivalent definition, at least for the E half of the decomposition, would be to say that this should have been U of x. In real space, a mode is an E mode if I can take a scalar function f and apply these two operators to it to get q and u. Sort of like the way you define what it means for a vector field to be a gradient. There's one underlying scalar function and two differential operators that you apply to get the components. Okay, now if you compare that to the way q and u are defined here, another way of saying the same thing is to say that the polarization tensor is just given by applying this operator. B minus 1/2 delta AB del squared F. Where this term's purpose in life is to make the result traceless. By translating to real space, we get the generalization to the curved sky, a mode, a polarization mode PAB on the curved sky is an E mode. On the curved sky, a polarization field PAB is an E mode if I get it by applying this operator this second order differential operator to F for some scalar function F. For the to go if I go through the same algebra for the B mode, then I need to introduce so generally speaking, every n manifold with a metric has a volume form on it, which is an anti-symmetric tensor with n indices. For the sphere, that's a an anti-symmetric two tensor, so the two sphere. So recall that the two sphere has a covariantly constant volume form or anti-symmetric two tensor epsilon AB. That's just defined, you know, a concrete description is at any point on the sphere, you take an orthonormal frame and the volume form is, you know, this anti-symmetric matrix. That prescription is conserved under preserved by rotation of the coordinate system. Okay, so with this in this notation, PAB is a B mode. I won't go through the algebra. It's not hard to go through the algebra and see how this properly generalizes the flat sky case. A mode is a B mode if I apply this operator. For some f. Generally speaking, there's a this is similar to the gradient curl decomposition for a vector field, but here we have an object with two indices and second order operators. So there's a little theorem that every polarization field on the sphere, every traceless symmetric tensor, can be uniquely decomposed, just like a as an E-mode let's call the underlying scalar potential F sub E plus a B-mode. You'll partially prove this theorem in a homework problem. You can see that this is true. Oops. Of course, this is true on the flat sky just because I can invert a rotation matrix and for every pair QL, UL, rotate and get the associated EL, BL. So this is the E mode. And this is the B mode. Furthermore, there's a just like a scalar field, like the CMB temperature, can be written out uniquely in its spherical harmonic coefficients. The invertible transform between T in real space and ALM in harmonic space is the spherical analog of the Fourier transform. There's a complete basis of E mode and B mode spherical harmonics, so I can decompose PAB. Another thing that I can do if I want to go, this is the EBD composition written out in real space. In harmonic space, I just have a sum over L. So there are objects YE there are these tensor spherical harmonics. As you might guess, they're defined by just applying these E-mode and B-mode differential operators to the ordinary spherical harmonics, the scalar spherical harmonics. And so you can uniquely represent the E-mode part by the sequence of coefficients ALMB and the B-mode part by the sequence of coefficients ALMB. One little like piece of trivia here is that in the polarization case, the sum starts at L equals 2. To make that, there's no such thing as a polarization monopole or dipole. One way this may make some intuitive sense is that if you think about a vector field, the case of a single index, then the sum starts at L equals 1. There's no such thing as like a vector field monopole. There's this theorem in math, sometimes called the hairy ball theorem, that says that there's no way to continuously define a vector field on the sphere, which is non-zero everywhere. If you could you can do it in a small patch, but if you try to do it globally, you eventually run into trouble. The arrows run into each other, and the vector field has to go to zero by continuity. Likewise, a vector. So for a vector field, the sum would start at L equals 1. There's no such thing as a vector monopole. That would be some sort of vector field which looks like a uniform motion everywhere in the sphere. And that's fine in a little patch, but you can't do it globally. The polarization case, it turns out, it makes intuitive sense that there's no monopole. I don't know such an intuitive way to see that there's no such thing as a polarization dipole, but it is in fact true that the sum starts at L equals 2. One more important comment is that these potential functions are, the E-mode potential function is a scalar. You know, it transforms in the usual way. Under rotations and under flips, but this function f sub b is a pseudoscalar quantity. It transforms in the usual way under rotations, but if I flip, I get an extra minus sign. Okay. Now I'd like to prove this theorem. Okay, so I haven't proven every statement up here, but there's a homework problem where you'll explore this a little more. I want sort of prove this theorem, a symmetry theorem that I mentioned last time. So in linear perturbation theory, fluctuations in zeta, or any scalar source, or any scalar, any set of, you know, scalar fields, only generate E modes. So, you'll recall last time I said that, you know, we have the standard cosmological model, where the initial fluctuations in the universe are just fully parametrized by this single 3D field zeta, which is a scalar quantity. I offer the following proof by picture. Here's the CMB sky. In linear perturbation theory, every Fourier mode evolves independently, so I can pretend that the whole universe is just a isotropic FRW background, plus a perturbation with some wave number k, choosing coordinates so that that wave number points in the z direction. This perturbation is in the initial conditions. If I let it evolve through some complicated physics, arbitrarily complicated physics, but it has to be linear. The assumption here, which I think I always forget to write down, is that the physics is rotation invariant, translation invariant, and importantly, parity invariant. Okay. I already implicitly use translation invariance when saying that the universe evolves one Fourier mode at a time. And I suppose rotation invariance by choosing coordinates. Anyway, so here's the picture. And so let's imagine that this scalar mode in the initial conditions, produces some pattern of linear polarization on the sky. Decompose that pattern into its E and B mode components and find the associated scalar and pseudoscalar quantities FE and FB. These are functions defined on the sphere. You know, that you could paint on. So FE will just be some function defined on the sphere with level contours. Same goes for FB. This picture, the initial conditions, are symmetric under rotation around the axis of the wave vector k. So in these coordinates, we know by symmetry that FE is a function of theta only, not likewise for FB. If we now think about a second symmetry, namely the parity symmetry through an arbitrarily chosen plane containing the k vector, then that will take FE to. So that preserves the initial conditions, so we should see exactly the same pattern of FE and FB on the sphere in a flipped coordinate system. But such a transformation would reverse the sign of B. And the only way that's consistent is if FB is zero. That's the proof of the theorem. Essentially, one way of saying it is that a single K mode is invariant under rotations around the wave number and also parity flips through the wave number. And that combination of symmetries just doesn't allow a B mode. There's just no B mode pattern on the sphere that's consistent with those symmetries. Another way of saying it is that a B mode is secretly a pseudoscalar, and there's just no way to evolve a scalar initial fluctuation to a pseudoscalar at some later time. That's just not consistent with symmetry. Yeah?
How does going to higher order in perturbation theory give rise to a B mode?
That certainly does happen, for example, by gravitational lensing. This just breaks the assumption of the proof. I mean, I guess one thing you can say is that I could evolve the universe, say at second order, I could evolve the universe two wave numbers at a time. It would suffice to consider initial conditions where I have the sum of two perturbations in the initial conditions. But this has much less symmetry. It doesn't have the rotation symmetry, which is crucial to make the argument work. So sources of B modes. This is just a really fundamental thing about CMB polarization. It's kind of amazing that this was only worked out in like 1997. Nowadays we do the experiments and we just see that the B mode is way smaller than the E mode on the sky. Sources of B modes by this theorem are second order effects, the largest of which by far is gravitational lensing. If I view one second order effect is that even if the last scattering surface viewed through an empty universe is imprinted with a pattern that's only E. If I view it through a gravitational lens, I get a mixture of mostly E and a small amount of B. Non-scalar sources. Which in single field slow roll inflation, there's only one such source around, namely the gravity waves. A gravity wave excites many components of the metric, including components that don't transform as scalars under reflection. Another little symmetry theorem is that there's no correlation possible between TB and EB, assuming only parity invariant statistics. I don't need to assume anything about the physics here. Rotation invariance as well. That's easy to show because the most general correlation between, say, T and B that would be allowed by rotation invariance is the usual form with some power spectrum. This is the definition of the power spectrum. And then if I flip, I'm going to reverse B but not T, thus reversing the sign of CLTB. And the only way that's consistent with symmetry is if CLTB equals 0. So CLBB is the only power spectrum in town when it comes to analyzing B modes. Let's talk about, right now we're, cosmology is largely finished with the temperature, CMB cosmology is largely finished with the temperature era, at least as far as measuring primordial fluctuations is concerned. They've almost all the modes in the temperature that correspond to primordial perturbations have been measured by Planck. And we're sort of in the middle of the E-mode era. E-modes have been measured by Planck and other experiments with error bars that look visually very impressive, but are in fact larger by a factor of a few than temperature, and that will improve at some point, and E-mode errors will be as good as temperature. And we're just sort of starting the B-mode era, where the measurements are getting into the interesting range. So the cosmological information, let's talk about E-modes first. So I had this picture up last time where I said that the way that you should think about CMB temperature, roughly, is that you take the CMB temperature power spectrum. What you see when you look at these peaks, roughly speaking, is the initial scalar power spectrum, the power spectrum of zeta, processed by a transfer function. So first off, viewed in angular space, so that an L here corresponds to a wave number kd, where d is the distance to the last scattering surface. And with some cosmological parameter-dependent transfer function, which is roughly diagonal in k, which is just multiplying this curve to produce the peaks. If I put a little feature here, it just shows up as some feature here. Now, E-mode polarization is qualitatively similar, but just with a different transfer function. If I make this TE or EE, there's just some different transfer function with different dependence on the cosmological parameters. I'll talk about the physics of the CMB more systematically later. But because the transfer functions are different, the following important thing happens. If I want to invert this arrow and reconstruct the primordial power spectrum from the observed CLs, there's a degeneracy between cosmological parameters, which are affecting the transfer function, and the primordial power spectrum itself. That just has to happen because we're trying to fit a free function plus some extra parameters from a free function. So a simple case to think about would be, what if I change the cosmological constant, leaving the initial power spectrum fixed? Changing the cosmological constant is a simple case to think about because that actually leaves the physics of the initial plasma the same. The only thing it changes is that we get to view the plasma at a different distance. So we're seeing perturbations, 3D perturbations that have the same physics, just viewed at a perturbed distance when I perturb the cosmological constant. All that does is shift the peaks. If I change the cosmological constant, I just shift the peaks by some multiplicative factor. Shift the peaks in L, keeping all the heights the same. And there'll be just some accidental degeneracy with changing the primordial power spectrum. If I take out a little power here, and then I put in a little power over here, and so on, there'll be some sequence of wiggles that I can put in that's degenerate with the cosmological constant lambda. And there are five more parameters in the base cosmological model. Well, rather, four parameters that aren't parameterizing the initial power spectrum itself. So right now we're in a situation where mostly we can invert, but there's accidental degeneracy between parameters which control the shape of this power spectrum, like the spectral index NS, and cosmological parameters in the transfer function. So E-mode polarization really helps because it's breaking all those degeneracies because the transfer function is different. So when we measure E-modes, as well as we've measured temperature, our errors on the measurement of the primordial power spectrum will get quite a bit better. And not parametrically better, but better by an order one factor, which is larger than you might think. So that's E-mode polarization. B-mode polarization. In the near future, when E-modes are measured well, we can hope for sort of 0.1% accuracy. We can measure this independently of parameters like lambda, and we can hope for sort of 0.1 accuracy, at least at the largest k's where we can measure the power spectrum. B-modes. This is a really exciting observational front. So we have If you're an experimenter, the plot that you stare at all the time is the plot that of the B-mode power spectrum, where there's a guaranteed foreground from gravitational lensing, and then there is a possible bump, actually two bumps, from gravity waves at low L. So what we're searching for here is, so in the standard cosmological model without gravity waves, the metric at early times looks like this. This equation defines the adiabatic curvature. When we search for gravity waves with no time dependence here, when we search for gravity waves, let me say exactly what we're looking for. We're looking for a background like this. A perturbation like this. Where gamma satisfies the following conditions that make it a gravity wave. It's traceless, and it's if I take one covariant derivative and contract, I get zero. This condition just means that the components of the metric parallel to the wave vector k, the wave vector of propagation, are zero. So the gravity wave consists of purely transverse excitations in the metric. We look for exactly what we're looking for is a power spectrum of gamma. Not sure at what level of detail makes sense here. Let me define exactly how the power spectrum of gamma is defined a little later. But just like the model includes cosmological parameters that correspond to the amplitude and slope of the scalar power spectrum. I haven't exactly explained how this power spectrum is defined because it's a non-scalar quantity, but let me just gloss over that temporarily. There's a power spectrum of gamma which is usually assumed to be just scale invariant. Inflation does predict a small tilt, a small k dependence here. We normally don't, until we see gravity waves, there's no meaningful statement we can make about what their tilt might be. So at least for now, when we analyze observations, we just take a constant on the right-hand side. Okay, now observers usually parameterize the level of gravity waves. So this has been measured. This number is 2.2 times 10 to the minus 9. This number, we just have upper limits, but it's usually not quoted directly. What's usually quoted is the so-called tensor to scalar ratio. Which has a current upper limit around 0.09. That's the current best upper limit from the CMB. But of course, you can just convert. You can put in this factor. So since this number is immeasurable, you can just put it in to convert. In principle, the temperature power spectrum is sensitive to R. Gravity waves, you know, there's a theorem that says that only gravity waves are the only sources of B, aside from second order effects. But there's no theorem that prevents gravity waves from contributing to the temperature power spectrum. And indeed, they are there at some level. At low L, there's a little bump. You see a little bump peaked at L of around 20 from gravity waves. Most of our current constraining power actually still comes from temperature. So the limit, the 95% upper limit from temperature alone is around 0.2. But that limit is stalled and won't get any better because of this problem of cosmic variance. So you guys know that when you measure fluctuations at low L, there's an error bar equal to a fractional error bar of two, square root 2 over 2L plus 1 that you can never get rid of. You've measured all the modes that there are to measure in our Hubble volume. And there's a finite number of modes. And given a finite number of samples from a Gaussian, there's just a fundamental limit on how well you know the width of that Gaussian. So that actually makes so this problem of sample variance, irreducible errors because there's a finite sample of modes that it's ever possible to measure in principle, is sort of unique to cosmology. I can't think of any other type of science, maybe one of you guys can, where there's some sort of fundamental limit in nature that prevents us from repeating an experiment. So we're stuck with this. Well, E-modes will actually help quite a bit. E-modes will bring this down to something like 0.05. But we're stuck from making qualitative progress in temperature. But in B-modes, you can go way farther, like the ultimate sample variance limit. See, eventually you hit a limit. If you have a very low-level B-mode signal, eventually you hit a limit from the sample variance of the gravitational lensing signal. There are actually mathematical ideas for how to get around that, so-called delensing algorithms. But the fundamental limit from B-modes is something like R of order 10 to the minus 4. And it's probably at least mathematically possible to dig down further than this. I'm not actually aware, because there are these high-tech statistical ideas, these delensing ideas. The rough idea is that because you measure all the matter, and you can measure all the matter in the universe in some independent way, you know what the gravitational lens is, and so you can try to correct it to get back a measurement of the polarization that you would see if there were no gravitational lens. I'm not aware of any actual mathematical limit on how well you might be able to ultimately measure R, but of course there'll be some practical limit. Now what's interesting about the B-mode era is that because there's no fundamental limit, this constraint, right now the B-mode constraint is comparable to the temperature constraint, but it's going to improve very fast. If you add integration time on a fixed patch of sky, your statistical error on R goes as 1 over the number of detector hours, not 1 over the square root of the number of detector hours, as you might naively guess. And there's kind of a Moore's law at work where the experimenters are very good at adding fantastic numbers of detector hours on the sky. For my PhD thesis, which was in 2007, I wrote an analysis pipeline for an experiment that had 48 detectors. Nowadays, it's sort of routine to field thousands of detectors. And there are plans that'll probably be funded in the near future for fielding experiments with like order 10 to the 5 detectors. So you can imagine in a world where this limit is just scaling as the number of 1 over the number of detectors, things are going to improve fast. I would be surprised if we didn't get to R of 10 to the minus 2 in the next, say, 2 or 3 years. And I would guess that we can eventually get down to R of around 10 to the minus 3 or 10 to the minus 4. I don't really see any showstopper there. So the B-mode era in cosmology is going to be a huge improvement. I think, you know, the B-mode experiments have been improving for a long time, but no one really cares, have been sort of exponentially improving, but no one cares when you improve by, say, a factor of 10, if the upper limit on R goes from 100 to 10, and we already have this result from temperature established by WMAP. So they've sort of been quietly improving for a long time, and we're right now just crossing the threshold where they'll become super interesting. Okay.
Why are the B-mode effects predominantly at low L?
I glossed over a ton of physics. There's a lot of things I didn't explain. So the reason that the B-modes show up at low L is that, so the B-modes are generated, so generally CMB polarization That's a good question. Generally, CMB polarization is generated by Thomson scattering. If I have an electron that sits in a slightly inhomogeneous field of radiation, more precisely, if there's a quadrupole, if I'm an electron and I look around and I see a quadrupole in the temperature of the photon bath, the temperature is slightly higher here than it is here. I'm looking down a line of sight that extends into the blackboard. Then this electron will radiate linear polarization by Thomson scattering in this direction. If I'm looking out into the universe, I see linear polarization coming from both the low redshift electrons that have appeared after stars reionized the universe, and also at the very edge of the last scattering surface. Last scattering isn't perfectly thin, you know, it takes some time for the electrons to for the electrons to fall into hydrogen atoms. Only the edge of the last scattering surface, because if I went a little farther, I would have a tightly coupled plasma, which doesn't have these types of quadrupoles. So that's the first part of the answer to your question, is just understanding where in space the CMB polarization signal is coming from. Now, another thing which is true is that gravity waves show up at a characteristic size. So the wave number of the gravity wave, which is effective at producing observed linear polarization, is just the size of the causal horizon, which is parametrically AH, at the time when the polarization is emitted. The reason that gravity waves that come from this surface, they have a characteristic. So the physical wave number of the gravity waves that you see when you collect polarization from this surface is just the Hubble horizon here, the causal horizon. And the angular wave number where you see the gravity wave is the ratio between this horizon and the angular diameter distance to the CMB. Roughly the ratio between the horizon then and the horizon now. So these guys, the low redshift electrons, come from much longer wavelength gravity waves because the causal horizon has gotten bigger. And we also observe them at a shorter distance. So they show up at a much lower value of L. In fact, you know, if you do the estimate parametrically, you just get L of order 1. And so that is why when you look at the B mode power spectrum, if I plot it as CL rather than the customary L squared CL, then at low L, the gravitational lensing background looks flat. And the gravity wave background looks like two bumps. There's a bump at L of roughly 60. 60 is the ratio between the causal horizon at recombination and the distance, the horizon now. And then it's usually described as a second bump, but if you look at it closely, it's just more of a rising, almost like a power law, which is the signal from these low redshift electrons that's just showing up at the lowest Ls that you can measure. Okay. Here are some fairly robust predictions about what we measure when we measure B modes. So one fairly robust prediction is that the energy scale of the early universe, or its Hubble parameter H, is linked to gravity waves, and we'll derive this soon. So there's a factor of 1/4 here, which is just a convention in the way delta gamma is defined, normally defined. Which, expressed in terms of r. So I put in the 2.2 times 10 to the minus 5. It's this. Taking the square root and putting in the units. So there's a fairly robust link between the gravity wave power spectrum and the energy scale of the early universe, which doesn't exist for the scalar mode. Generally speaking, so this I think is easy to understand, this h squared over m Planck squared being the amplitude of the gravity wave. We saw that that fields during inflation, we did this calculation for a massless test scalar in De Sitter, are just generally excited with power spectra that go like, well, we found a factor of 2, h squared over k cubed. So power spectra of, you know, any sort of field that I put, that I throw into inflation, those fields generally get excited with power spectra of this form, h squared over k cubed. And that's what you're seeing here for the gravity wave. For the scalar sector, things are more complicated because I put in other fields. I put in the inflaton. And there'll be some canonically normalized combination of fields which still gets an expectation value of this amplitude. But it doesn't necessarily correspond to zeta. The details, there might be large factors relating the canonically normalized field to zeta. And so it's hard to give a model an independent interpretation of what you're actually seeing in the scalar power spectrum. Because we don't generally imagine, I suppose if you put in a bunch of other fields of spin 2 and tried to couple them to gravity, then you might be able to do the same, you might be able to create the same sort of complications in the gravity wave sector. But assuming that you just only like scalar fields and fields of lower spin, like vectors, are important during inflation, this is a very robust statement. Anyway, taking the square root and putting in the units, we get this. So GeV times r to the 1/2. So if we see r, if r is in the observable range from like 0.1 where we are now to like say 10 to the minus 4 where we'll eventually get, we'll be able to tell whether inflation happened at this sort of high characteristic energy. The energy scale of inflation is sometimes, rather than quoting h, a number with units of energy, the energy scale of inflation is sometimes quoted as the energy density to the 1/4, which by Friedman's equation is this. Putting in this formula for h, assuming that I did some calculations correctly at like 2 a.m., is this, which is the gut scale. So if we say that the electroweak scale and the gut scale are the only large energy scales that we have some sort of experimental evidence for in physics, we know that inflation couldn't have happened at the electroweak scale, or it would screw up other things. It would screw up Big Bang nucleosynthesis, for example. So maybe it happened at the gut scale, the natural hypothesis. If so, looking for r is the way to test. If you see r, then you know inflation happened at this energy scale. This statement is a little fuzzy because of this low power, right? Like if there's a parametric, if there's an order one factor, like a 1 over 4 pi that works against you, maybe that pushes r down by 4 pi to the 4th, and you don't see it. So the statement's a little fuzzy, but qualitatively speaking, that's what r is testing for. So the observational bottom line. Is that for various models of inflation, we want to calculate the scalar power spectrum to 0.1%. That's the level at which we'll measure it in the near future. The gravity wave power spectrum to 10 to the minus 4. But that's the fractional multiple of the 10 to the minus 4 times the scalar power spectrum. Observationally, we're going to measure r to 10 to the minus 4. And non-Gaussianity, which I just mentioned briefly, but that's one of the main things we're going to calculate. I mentioned briefly last time that observational constraints on primordial non-Gaussianity are at the 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 4 level. So we want to calculate this deviations from Gaussian statistics to about 1 part in 10 to the 4. These are the predictions that that a model of the early universe might give us that we want that we can compare with observations either now or in the near future. So next time, get ready for a lecture that might call Operation Infinite Algebra. I'm going to start following this classic paper by Maldacena, which is a really beautiful, physically transparent, and I would say the first really airtight, non-loophole-containing calculation of these observables for single-field slow-roll inflation.